Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Now, as I said before, we went over to the newsroom. The minister has left us. We have been joined by Dennis Daunton, deputy editor of the Irish Times, who spent some time in the United States, and Philip O'Connor, journalist living in Sweden, who kind of drops in here.
Well, usually on the way to the airport.
Thanks. That's right. Well, you're very welcome indeed. Can I start with you, Dennis? You've spent time living in the States. We just very briefly touched on it before before the news heads. Your own response, reaction to the story from Connecticut?
Well, obviously, it's a particularly shocking example of a particularly shocking phenomenon, which has become more frequent in the US. I think when I was there over a few years, I covered a couple of these massacres, one in Virginia Tech, the university, where a number of students were shot in classrooms and in dormitories. And then this other tragic case in a small school in Amish country in Pennsylvania, where again somebody went in. And it was quite similar to this because a lot of the victims were children. And the terrible thing about this is the same pattern tends to happen, which is that everybody says this is finally going to focus people on gun control, and it doesn't. And if you look at what's happened over the last 20 years, these things have become more common. Gun ownership has actually been declining in the United States over the last 20 years.
300 million, I read.
Yes, they have, but still actually fewer Americans as a proportion own guns than do. But what you've also seen is that support for gun control has also been declining. Mm. And so once again, you've seen this pattern of behaviour where people on the right and people who favour gun ownership, they tend to say now is not the time to have this conversation. It's disrespectful to the dead and we must talk instead about what happened. And the fact is, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people, all of that. And then by the time it is the right time to talk about it, of course, the boil has gone off it.
Yeah.
And you know, the other arguments that they make, and the guy, the felicitously named Larry Pratt, who is the executive director of Gun Owners of America, he gave a statement the other day, which was quoted in The Observer this morning, saying that gun control people have the blood of these children on their hands because the problem was that the only person allowed to have a gun in there was the killer, that none of the teachers had guns. And this is something that I had said to me in Virginia Tech.
So let's get more guns.
Exactly. Yes. The problem is that, you know, if the teachers had guns, they'd have been able to shoot
them. But how do you explain in a country like Britain, where there are very strict gun laws, you've had three mass killings?
Yes.
Hungerford, Dunblane, and most recently in the Lake District. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that David Frum has a very good piece in the Sunday Times today where he looks at precisely that, where he says that, of course, this phenomenon of disturbed people going on rampages is universal.
There was one in China.
Indeed, there have been a number, and there's a website in China that chronicles them, and there have been a number since 2010. But the point is, in most cases, people don't have access to guns, so they use whatever is the most lethal weapon they can find. Usually it's a knife or an axe or something. So the phenomenon of the rampage is something which happens. But the fact is that it is more difficult to get access to guns in most places.
Well, I tell you, there's an article in the New York Times Sunday Review just addressing all of that.
Yeah.
And of course it has happened all over the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But it happens more over there. And he was saying that, you know, they've got to accept the fact that you're never going to get the kind of control you have in countries like here. Nobody's going to ban guns, but like they have building codes to govern stairways. They've endless regulations about ladders, apparently, in schools. Mm-hmm. They've endless regulations about, teachers and so on. And that you could do some form of regulation. Now, I want to come to you in this, Phil, because aren't there guns relatively freely available
in
Sweden?
Yeah. If you look at the case of Anders Behring Breivik, who killed all those people in Norway that time, the guns that he used in that attack were actually legally held.
His own guns.
Yeah, they were his own guns. The same thing in Sweden. Because, it's partially true in America as well, the right to have a gun for hunting, for pistol clubs and that kind of thing, this is something that's very much related to freedom. Now, that's, you know, that goes exponentially in America. It's not about the gun. I usually describe it as the most politically loaded thing in America is the gun thing. But Breivik had this thing, you know, he had the gun there. But there's also, it's an entirely different culture when it comes down to it. And I also think that, you know, people ask me about Breivik. He was actually found to be sane when he was committed get it. But then the thing is that, you know, I think there's, you have to be mad to go and kill that many people with a gun on some level, you know, whether it be criminally or otherwise. I think that the supports kind of exist in Europe in a way that they don't in America. I think that people are very much left to their own devices in America, whereas maybe in Europe we have a sort of an early warning system that might pick that up. And then, of course, sorry, Tom, the one thing that if you do remove it from any of these situations that stops these things happening, the one thing that makes the big difference is the gun. You take the gun out of it, these things don't happen. I know there will be attacks with knives and that, but
yeah,
nothing
the
on the scale that we've
China
seen.
was with knives. Sorry, John,
I think we're deluding ourselves. Gun control will not end this. There are some times when you've got to accept that there are things that happen in society that you can't stop. And pretending that gun control will change it, I don't believe it will. If tomorrow morning the gun control is introduced in America, there's still, what, is 300 million guns out there? I mean, if you want to get a gun, you can get a gun.
Well,
in a couple
of hours. I was telling on the programme yesterday, I remember being in the States and going into Walmart. My son was quite young at the time. You could buy any gun you wanted. I was absolutely so gobsmacked. I could have walked up there and bought any gun I wanted.
I think there is an important... Tom is right, of course, that gun control won't stop these things. But one of the important things that has happened and has changed is the kind of guns that people own in the US. Only 5% of Americans go hunting. Mm. And the kind of guns they used to own were relatively simple and not... they were straightforward guns that you had to reload. If you look
like
at the,
you would have here if somebody going out
If you look at the case of
dog.
This guy, James Holmes in Colorado, who went into the cinema at the Dark Knight... Exactly, the Batman guy. And in the space of 90 seconds, he was using an assault rifle. In the space of 90 seconds, he was able to shoot 71 people, killing 12 of them. Because these things shoot 60 rounds a minute. And so, one of the political element of all of this is that the National Rifle Association has adopted what has been the most effective kind of political lobbying in America, which is to say, absolutely no restrictions of any kind on anything. And it's a little bit like Grover Norquist and the tax people, where they say no tax increases of any kind, and there's a sort of a litmus test, where a purity test, and so they resist everything, which means.
But I think that's another myth, that if you do away with certain types of weapons, it's an appalling thing to say, but a single barrel shotgun walking into the school, it would have taken longer. He could have still killed 26 people. So removing automatic rifles will not make that much difference.
If you have to reload and all that,
but he had to reload.
Can I come to you on a question? I don't know if you can throw any insight into that. Why do these people go to kill children? Like, if you hate adults because they're bad to you, or you hate the teacher, or if you hate the bank manager, or whatever, but why do they go in and mass kill children?
What's interesting, Marion, is that there's an awful lot of research, actually, very good psychological research on what are called homicides, suicide, multiple killers. And you can describe, actually, really accurately the kind of person who's going to do that. The unfortunate thing is you can't predict it. So, for example, one of the myths we have is that these things are, we're always kind of shocked because it happened in a small idyllic town or, in Dunblane or something like that.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the norm. These killings are far more likely to happen in small, intimate communities. And they're far more likely to happen in places like the workplace, a movie theatre, a school in particular, because there's a contagion effect there as well. And when you look at the profile of people who do it, they're not mentally ill in the sense of, off their heads, kind of crazy, psychotic, it's not that.
The
evidence actually is that they're not. The evidence is that they tend to be, almost predominantly male. They tend to be people who are angry, who have a long history of personal failure behind them.
This guy was brilliant at school.
Yes, but social failure. So that's the beginning, is that they have this long... That doesn't make them multiple killers. The second thing that has to happen is that they get to a point in their lives where there's a kind of an accumulation of that sense of personal failure, and they're very isolated, and then they begin to blame other people, a person or a group of people that they believe are now responsible solely.
But they're not 5-year-old children.
But then the third thing is that they then as it were, there's a trigger event. So nearly always there's, you know, a threat of separation, maybe a marital separation, being thrown out of a house, you know, losing your job, something, a big financial crisis. Do you remember that guy in Cumbria last year, the taxi driver? And then what happens is that their whole mind kind of contracts and they become utterly focused on taking revenge. And they take the revenge is often random, or it may be have a personal association, like this was the school his mom taught in. He presumably had some kind of dispute with his mother. And so what then happens is that they simply do not see the people as people. So it's irrespective if they're innocent bystanders, children, they see them as targets. They simply are planning like target, you know.
Right. Stephen, you want to
Well, 2 points. One, I disagree with Tom that, you know, the prevalence of gun availability doesn't have an impact. I think all these gun massacres in the States, and it's not just supposition on my part, again, reading stuff online this morning, there is no doubt that statistically there is much more of these kind of gun massacres in the States than in any other Western society. Interestingly, in the case of what Maureen said, again, reading online, this guy was a former pupil of this school where he carried out the massacre. One of the people who knew him well from his time said he was a very strange kid. And he used an interesting line about him. He said that he was the kind of kid that if he was to suffer a burn, he wouldn't react. He said, you know, if he was burnt by hot water, he just wouldn't react. Now, again, actually, the other stuff online this morning says, in fact, his mother wasn't teaching in the school.
Yeah,
there.
The New York Times this morning clarified that his mother wasn't
a teacher.
Had no association with the school.
But amazingly, and again,
mother's guns.
But taking up Maureen's point about the kind of freakishness about this guy went to particular classrooms. He bypassed, apparently, some classrooms with children in them, but had in mind particular classrooms. Now, he also has a posting, I think, on some website or some blog or whatever saying from mid last week, that I'm going to act on Friday morning, I'm going to be famous and all this kind of stuff.
But thing about being famous, sorry Philip, you wanted to come in, I'll come to you then, Tom.
That was probably the greatest thing that happened out of the horror that happened in Oslo and Utøya at that time, was that Breivik actually survived. And Breivik was actually able to go to his own trial and explain what it was that he did. Mm. And he spoke exactly about that thing of dehumanising people. He literally sat there, he didn't see these as children or teenagers. He saw them as, you know, future communists. He saw them as the enemy. And he executed them. He just shot kids in the head. And interestingly, you know, the fallout from this is going to be interesting because, as Dennis was saying, you know, you'll get the gun lobby saying this is not the time to talk about this. The Norwegian government had what they call the 22nd of July Commission, and everything was on the table. The police got it. The politicians, Stoltenberg, everybody thought he was the great statesman, the Norwegian Prime Minister, he got it. The Department of Justice got it. Everybody got it because everybody was seen as being culpable. Everybody was hauled over the coals. This never happens in the States. There is no.
But has it changed anything in Norway? Is it just the political classes pretending they're effective?
I think there's been a massive shift in Norway because despite the fact
in what kind of way?
In that if you look at Obama's tears the other day, right, they will mean absolutely nothing unless something changes. Stoltenberg got up there and he talked about the nation and everything else, and he has had to take an awful lot of criticism to the point where some people expected him to resign. And there's no doubt that since that day, both since the 22nd of July itself and since the report came out, Norway's a totally different country.
Yeah. But there are 3,000...
In what way?
It's different in that Norway has matured. It has been forced to look at this thing of its own.
Has it changed any of the regulations about guns?
Not just yet, but it certainly has changed the way people look at security. If you walk around what used to be where the government buildings were, that was where the bomb was exploded. There was never surveillance in Norway. When I landed from Gatwick and I heard that the bomb went off, and I went, Oslo, of all places. It's the quietest. It's like Moat. It's the quietest place you've ever
but
been.
Surely
sorry, Moat.
But it's just as beautiful as Moat as well.
But surely
but
the
fact,
crisis.
There's no security measures you can take against people like this.
Surely the crisis in Connecticut is suicide, not weapons and gun laws.
But again, Tom, remove the gun and this doesn't happen.
How to remove 300 million
weapons? Well, actually, I mean, Tom, actually, there is a point. I mean, I absolutely agree about the guns, because there's only so much damage you can do, you know, even physically with a knife, you know, like the China thing. You know, guns and automatic guns, just they multiply the victims. There isn't, we know those profiles of those kind of loner, kind of aggrieved, angry men in particular. What's interesting is that if you look at the statistics right throughout the 20th century, the only dip that there was in these sort of, you know, rampages was in the 1950s. And I think there's a clue there, actually, you know, but it would require a very complicated solution, which is that men, to function well, seem to need structures in their lives. You know, if they're married and they're in sort of secure employment and, you know, they're kind of living in a structured world, they seem to function very well. And of course, the 1950s was a time when, say, in America, you know, men had, they had lifelong jobs, they were married, they had kids, they went to church, etc. But once men fall out of structures, like, you know, a relationship breaks up or they lose custody of a child or something, or, you know, they're isolated from their peer group, they are extraordinarily vulnerable.
But if you look at popular culture, Marion, look at American television. How many people are killed every day on television?
That's a fair point.
At the centre of popular culture is the gun.
So I spent a lot of time morning, actually in the Southwest, which is the kind of capital,
America
and
has,
everyone carries guns.
America has created this myth around the frontier.
That's right. Try the Southwest. The gun,
defend yourself, blah, 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 blah. Now, this man's mother, Nancy, took them as kids to shooting. A family outing to go shooting with automatic
weapons.
Michael
Moore made the point.
She owned the weapons.
Remember Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore movie about this? Yeah. And, you know, he makes all sorts of points, and some of them are interesting. But he made the point, the difference between America and Canada in this regard. And he made the point that there were precious few examples of these rampages in Canada. And he deducted because the gun control was tighter. That was his deduction. Mm. It could also be done, what Maureen talks about, the society is more cohesive. You tend to have less fend-for-yourself attitude, etc. But it is interesting. You've got two broadly similar cultures share a massive, massive border with each other. One society is not characterised, but suffers every now and then from these type of massacres. The other one doesn't.
But David, the figures actually, Tom, I have to say, do suggest that guns are a problem in America, insofar as the crime rate for most crimes is relatively similar to that in other developed countries and has been falling. But the murder rate is much higher than it is in similar sort of countries. And so it's clear that, I mean, and, you know, and obviously this is a terrible tragedy that happened, but these are not the only victims of gun crime in America this weekend. In Chicago, you will have, like by Saturday morning, there had been 10 people shot in Chicago on Friday night. So that, and that was a place that was also mentioned by President Obama. But I think that my fear about your Council of Despair is that because we can't stop all crime by gun control, we shouldn't take any measures. Whereas, in fact, you could restrict not only the kind of weapons that are available, but also ammunition. What Marion was talking about going into Walmart, the Walmart don't do it anymore, but in many other places in the US, it is easy to in many parts of the US to buy a gun and to buy ammunition than it is to rent a car.
But isn't this also an extension of the whole American militarism? They're obsessed with armies and guns.
Well, they possibly are, but I don't think, my personal experience of them is not that they are necessarily more intrinsically murderous
as people
than the rest of us.
No,
well, it's just greater opportunity. Listen, I'm watching my clock and I'm going to have to move on, not to be dismissive of 20 children being killed, but anyway, what you were writing yourself, Tom, today about Pat Finucane case.
Well, there's a piece also in the Sunday Times, and a Jim Cusack piece in Sunday Independent. I just really sort of standing up and looking at that relationship between the secret society and the way in which the inquiry opened up an extraordinary vista of the linkages between the British secret state and the number of people who have been killed and targeting people like Finucane. And I know the family are calling for a public inquiry. It will never happen. There's no possibility of such a thing that the British political state would put the secret state in public to ask questions. But I think it's important to realise that I've always felt that for a long time loyalist paramilitarism was run at a distance by the secret state, and it was used to defeat the IRA, and it was also used to bring about the peace process. I just think it has to be recognised in the context of this Finucane thing.
Yeah, I was listening to somebody from another northerner on talking during the week and saying that, and I know that the Finucane family, no relation, are really determined to stick at this. Do you think at this point, now they got I know that Geraldine said that she didn't, but in a way it revealed how the system operated in a very clear way. Now she said Cameron apologised, what did he apologise for? But did you think that Cameron actually was right to do that?
There's a huge attempt to protect responsibility because people say, did somebody give these people orders?
Yeah.
Were they responsible as some sort of politicians? The answer is no. The answer is it's a very interesting that the agents are run. And if you're an agent and I'm running you, nobody knows you're an agent except me. And we can go off and do our own thing. And there are agents being run all over the place. So there's no central control. No politician ever said you can't do this or we're going to do this. So curiously enough, this exists beyond political control, which may seem hard to believe. And the less ministers know, the less they'll be asked questions in the House of Commons.
Douglas Hogg mentioned.
Yes, he did.
He was briefed.
Not Finucane, but he said a solicitor.
Yeah.
And that was, what, a couple of weeks before the
I think he said solicitors.
Suggesting there was some connection. Or at least
there were three or four solicitors that were targeted at the time. Curiously, one of them was PJ McCrory, who's now dead, and his son is now the Attorney General at Stormont, which is an interesting thing. We'll see what the PSNI attempt to approach. There is one outing for the Finucane family in terms of the European Court of Human Rights and the right to life. The inquiry clearly points out that his right to life was not protected by the authorities. So there may be an opening there, I don't know.
Right, well, it looks like that they're not going to let it go. Anyway, we are going to move on to our stories that are making headlines, the other stories that are making headlines around the rest of the world. So some of our guests are leaving us now. The minister left earlier on. David McWilliams, Maureen Gaffney, Tom McGurk, Stephen O'Byrne. Philip, are you staying or going?
I'll stick around if you want.
Right, okay.
What time's the flight?
I might be better than you.
Okay, listen, thank you all very much indeed for your time, and we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme. Well, the Japanese are voting in a general election. The Egyptians are voting on a new constitution. A terrible typhoon in the Philippines has killed more than 1,000 people. There have been violent anti-Putin rallies in Moscow. Hillary Clinton is suffering from concussion after a fall. And it's reported that Barack Obama will nominate John Kerry as the next Secretary of State. So let's have a look at some of those stories. But yesterday in the UK, well, come to that in a second. But first of all, I want to introduce another guest into studio with us, because our other guests have left, and with us now are Dennis Staunton, Philip O'Connor and Dave Mulville. You're very welcome indeed into the programme. You're another kind of drop-in, drop-out person, aren't you?
I am, yeah. Half my time here and half my time in the Middle East.
In the Middle East. Doing?
I run a software development company, so we have an office in Beirut in Lebanon, and we do a lot of work all over the Middle East, and I've been in and out of that part of the world for the last 20-odd years.
Right.
So
Libya,
Lebanon, Saudi, Qatar, Dubai, Abu Dhabi would be typical hunting grounds for us. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to start nonetheless with the hoax where the woman took her own life, the Moore suicide. Dennis, you were looking at that?
Yeah, it was this tragic story of this nurse, Jacinta Saldana, who was working in the hospital where Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge, was being treated for morning sickness. And these Australian radio DJs called and pretended to be the Queen as a hoax and everything else, and she seemed to give them some information. Anyway, she was terribly, terribly embarrassed by the whole thing, and it seems possibly because of that she took her own life. And yesterday there was a memorial service for her in Westminster Cathedral, and her husband and her two children, her son and her daughter, gave very, very moving tributes to her, where it was clear here was this very hardworking Indian immigrant family. Mm-hmm. And the son particularly was just speaking about how their mother had been the centre of the family and had kept everything together.
Right.
And it is one of those just terrible things where you just wonder why.
Yeah. The other thing, Philip, because I know that you were looking at the coverage of it as well, we were talking earlier on about suicide and how everybody tiptoes around, you know, and you don't want to speak ill of the dead, and you talk that they're in a better place and all of that, and that maybe that's not the best way to go about it. I mean, she wrote three notes. One about the DJs in Australia, blaming them for what was about to happen.
It's an interesting one, and it's also the way that's been reported as being is interesting as well. I saw a piece this morning, I think it was in The Observer, where they suggested that this woman had decided to take her own life and that maybe there was more than one attempt before she succeeded. So the three notes weren't written at the same time, but they were written for different attempts or different planned attempts at suicide. And this is the big problem when you have such a case under the spotlight, because the royal family is involved, it's international, it's in Australia, it's here, it's there. And there's a huge sort of spotlight turned on this tragedy, and it gets blown up, as the case in Donegal gets blown up as well, where yeah. we have two sisters. In Sweden, they don't actually report suicide as a cause of death at all. If they
yeah,
can
that
possibly
used
avoid
to
it.
Be the way here, yeah.
Yeah, and the reason being that it's the copycat thing, right? We'll find as well, with the, like the slayings now in the school in the States, that you, if you get one, you get a little sort of a tail after it of people who do the same thing. They'll see an outpouring of grief. They'll see coverage in the media. It might be, as Maureen mentioned, that, you know, somebody who has turned against themselves or against society, and they say, right, I'm going to do this and I'm going to teach everybody. But if you kill off the oxygen of publicity, that may be, you know, what they see as their redemption, that at least in death they will get the respect that they didn't
yeah, see,
get in
life.
See,
one of the problems here was when we didn't report it, and as Maureen again said, if it was said that somebody died by suicide, they couldn't be buried in consecrated ground if they were Roman Catholics. So it was kind of seen as progress mm-hmm. and more kind of humanitarian to mm-hmm. you know, to tell the truth if it was death by suicide rather than conceal it.
But I suppose the difficulty is it's very hard, as you were saying earlier, to determine the truth and, you know, to work out why exactly anybody has taken this step. And so, for example, of course, I agree it's not fair to blame these DJs. They really were doing what they felt was a kind of a harmless prank.
Oh, listen, we've all done them.
Indeed, do exactly.
Know?
And I think, you know, having said that, there is a kind of an element of cruelty in a lot of this, where you're dealing with regular members of the public who really just, you know, aren't necessarily equipped yeah. to deal with a big media storm. So, but clearly the intention
well, I mean,
of the DJs
yeah.
was quite yeah. mild and benign.
What they didn't do was follow through to get their permission to use it, because that's what you yes. normally do. Does this thing happen in the Middle East at all?
I've heard of it once or twice. I know people who have been sort of the victims of radio prank calls out there, and I know one particular person who got very, very upset about it. But I think the thing that I took from that story was the whole issue about the blame game on the journalists and the fact that they're now in hiding. There's been death threats against them as well. And clearly the consequences of what happened wasn't something in their heads when they did this. You know, I thought it was an easy thing for people to latch onto and just blame them without necessarily looking at, right. you know, the reality of the facts behind her own situation.
See, yeah. The other thing is about the conversation about suicide. Where do we have that? Do we have to have that in the media? Or are we better off to have it at a local level, in schools, in families, in that kind of thing? And there's a huge issue around mental illness, just in general. And certainly in Irish families, there's a huge issue around drink, around depression, that we don't talk about. And suicide was part of that for a long time. Now, when we splash it all over the front pages, I don't think it's given us the positive effect that we would like. Now we're aware of it, and yet we still have a massive problem with it, maybe because of the
and
economic
situation.
And so
what happens in Sweden if somebody does die by suicide?
It just reports a sudden death. You know, they'll give the cause of death as being, you know, as you know, as clouded as possible, you know, and it's kind of the thing where the dogs in the street tend to know. Journalists always know what killed anybody, you know, but they don't report that because they don't want to draw attention to that fact. Occasionally, you can't help it, you know. But I know that, you know, there's firemen that I know who are, you know, picking up bodies off tracks. Sweden always has this reputation as, you know, the highest suicide rate in the world. In yeah. fact, it's not. It's at number 30. Ireland is at number 36, and the statistics per 100,000 are very, very close together. So the problems are quite similar, but the way we deal with them is slightly different. And what I'd like to see is that discussion, you know, if we move the suicide discussion off the front pages and into the youth clubs and the schools and the Gaelic football and the hurling clubs around
yeah,
the country.
Just so as long as it's not glamorous.
No, exactly, because the idea now that, you know, the outpouring of tragedy, the almost Shakespearean tragedy that's happened in Donegal, will actually have the opposite to the intended effect on some young people. They will see this and they will see that box at the front of the church and they'll say, I want to be there. That
well,
is the
problem is
thing
Maureen was saying that the research shows that statistically the possibility
it's 2.5 times more likely to happen in the area again, yeah.
Anyway, moving on, and America is in the news again. Dave, you reckon that John Kerry would be a good choice for Secretary of State as far as the Middle East is concerned?
Yeah, I think Kerry's a very well-respected politician. He's been active in the last number of years in Afghanistan and around the region. I don't think he'll be taken as a bad choice. I think the interesting thing about this is how his nomination has come around, and the fact that Susan Rice, the current US ambassador to the UN, has withdrawn her candidacy as a result of what appears to be a cover-up or an alleged cover-up over the way that the information around the attack on the Libyan compound, or the US compound in Libya, in Benghazi, which led to the death of the ambassador,
Was reported. Why did she get into trouble over
that? Well, I think the interesting thing was there was a briefing that went out, a White House briefing that went out that basically said that this demonstration and attack was as a result of the video that was posted on the internet a couple of months ago called The Innocence of Muslims, which was basically defamatory to Islam and caused widespread protests throughout the Middle East. In actual fact, the attack appears now to have been an Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-esque operation on the anniversary of the September 11th attack in New York. So this happened on September 11th. When the briefing went out, they were pushing this line, basically, that this was a purely, you know, instantaneous thing as opposed to a premeditated attack. And the implication of that message was that Obama's hard line on Al-Qaeda wasn't being weakened in the run-up to the US election. So that's how that story emerged. And I think it's very interesting. The Republicans obviously have gone crazy on this over the last week. And they've argued that, you know, he's done a deal to sacrifice rice, basically.
Well, that's what I thought. He was pretty spineless, I have to say.
The whole thing was kind of peculiar because she had been a great old pal of his and had been one of the early supporters and was one of his foreign policy advisors before the election, like the 2008 election. And so that was the first time she kind of got up the nose of John McCain, who, as you remember, was his Republican opponent.
Yes.
So John McCain was leading the charge with other Republican senators against the idea of Susan Rice. But the whole thing was odd because normally for these jobs, the president nominates you. And then once you're nominated, you get this whole support system. Whereas she was a kind of so-called unofficial candidate, like the name was out there, but she didn't have this support. And so Obama did. Being President Obama's friend is not necessarily the most comfortable place to be because he did leave her twisting a little. And then, she issued this statement saying she was withdrawing her candidacy.
Can we imagine? Did he have a chat with her on the phone and say, well, you know, Hillary's going and I have you in mind for the job. How would you feel about it?
Well, I can't imagine that she would have gone out there, allowed herself to go out there.
If that hadn't happened.
If there hadn't been something like that. And also he had appeared to be backing her. When he, earlier on, when he said, you know, at one of the press conferences, you know, don't come after her, come after me if you've got a problem with all of this. But then the other curious personal thing in it is that John Kerry, although he's a Democrat, is a great pal of John McCain and Lindsey Graham. They're all on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee together. They all go off on their various congressional delegations all over the world. And so the idea of having John Kerry as Secretary of State would please them as well. And so he shouldn't have any problem getting through. The problem could be for the Democrats to hold his Senate seat in Massachusetts if, as the rules state now, in Massachusetts there has to be an election in the spring.
Where Scott Brown is lined Scott up Brown to come back in.
Yeah, exactly, and get the seat, the one who lost it last time. So there's, but what they can do is, and what they often do in Massachusetts, is that when the moment comes, they change the rules so that you don't have one. So,
yeah. Okay, well, listen, on that note, we have to take a break. With me in studio are Dennis Staunton, Dave Mulville and Philip O'Connor, back after this.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, Dave, you wanted to bring up the rendition story.
Yeah, this was a story that was reported in The Guardian, actually, this week, Marion, where the British government have agreed to pay a Libyan dissident family £2.2 million sterling over an MI6 aided rendition. A fascinating story that in 2004, this gentleman, Sami al-Saadi, and his family were basically bundled onto a plane in Hong Kong in a combined operation by the CIA and MI6, and he was rendered with his family back to Libya, where he was tortured under the Gaddafi regime then for a number of years. He was a dissident critic of the Gaddafi regime. But this came to light after the revolution finished, and basically they were picking over the embers of Moussa Koussa's office in Libya, who was the former head of security for the Gaddafi regime, and they found the correspondence between the CIA and MI6 and the Libyan regime, basically orchestrating the lifting of this guy in Hong Kong. So it's a phenomenal story.
I mean, you so rarely get evidence for what an absolutely filthy, murky world that is.
Yeah, and of course the thing was that rendition was authorised as a result of Tony Blair's visit to Gaddafi in the desert and the so-called deal in the desert, where in exchange for British contracts and the Libyans opening up to more transparency, etc., and you know, moving away from weapons of mass destruction, etc., etc. This rapprochement took place, and clearly one of the items on the Libyan side of the deal was we need this guy back, and one of the items on the British side of the deal was we need big oil contracts.
There was a related story came out this week too, where the European Court of Human Rights found the government of Macedonia to be guilty of conspiring with the Americans to arrange for the kidnap of a German citizen of Arab origin as part of this whole war on terror business, and who was likewise captured, rendered and tortured, and they and the court found evidence against the government of Macedonia. And so I think that now, years later, you're starting to see some level of accountability, because of course there were these secret prisons here in Europe as well as elsewhere in the world which were run by the CIA.
Prisons here in Europe?
Here in Europe. There was one apparently in Macedonia, one was supposed to have been in Poland. And there seems to be quite a lot of evidence to that effect, and there are very few denials of the fact that these existed. But
well, maybe all the changes in regimes right across North Africa and in the Middle East will lead to more hard evidence on that kind of thing.
They're usually very, very careful in terms of if there's a political involvement at all. There's always the clause of plausible deniability. You know, OK, you can do whatever you want, but just don't mention my name. Don't write anything down. Nothing is done via email, this kind of thing. So
except
it's interesting.
As David said, in Libya, they obviously kept a record of everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, all of these countries, particularly those with autocratic regimes, are run by their military intelligence. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how it works. It's the same
in Syria. But the interesting thing is, when there's a violent upheaval, that stuff usually gets preserved. You know, whereas if there's just, you know, change from one government to another in a democracy, a lot of that stuff gets put in the shredder the last day before they move out and the new guy moves in.
I suppose so.
Interestingly enough, of course, in the settlement, the £2.2 million sterling, the British government haven't admitted any liability, but they have paid the money.
Who have they paid the money to?
To the family of Sami al-Saadi and his family.
Make of that what you will.
Staying there, the Egypt referendum. You know, I was thinking about it today, and people on this side of the world get confused about Shia and Sunni. Do you think it's fair to say that it could be like an outsider looking at Ireland and thinking, Protestant, Catholic, aren't they all Christian?
Yeah, it's frankly, it's very similar. You know, the Sunni and Shia strands of Islam, and, you know, I don't understand the nuances of the differences particularly. But, you know, obviously this has become more of a radical issue in the last number of years, and I don't think that's the factor in Egypt in the elections. I think the Egyptian election is more about the dominance of the Muslim Brotherhood and the secularists in Egypt. And this morning it's reported that it looks like this new constitution has been voted in. About 56% of the popular vote, I think, was in favour of the Morsi adopted constitution, which obviously is pushing further towards the role of the religious
in
daily life and in the state. And you know, that is going to cause a lot of conflict and tension, I think, in Egypt over time.
Yeah, but I suppose a vote is a vote. You know, I mean, you don't want to, if you're on the side of something,
absolutely.
If it's a referendum,
you get what you wish for, you know.
Yeah. But there's a further vote next week, isn't there?
There is, I believe, another vote next week. And of course, the details of what's included in the constitution, etc., are all very vague. So people are voting more on a point of principle than on a point of substance.
And part of the difficulty people have with it is the ambiguity. But one of the interesting things that has happened over the last few weeks with President Morsi is that he has discovered that simply governing on the basis of support from the Muslim Brotherhood is not going to be enough. That there is, even though the opposition is fragmented, that nonetheless it is quite strong. There's a lot of people that can still, there's a hard core of people who will still go on the streets. They believe that the revolution is theirs and that the revolution is not over, and that they're determined that they're not going to allow an autocratic system to return.
Right. Now, the North Korea, mind you, the other thing, just as an aside, I mean, I presume that at the moment their tourism is destroyed, and I mean, if loads of Irish people would have gone on the Nile at some stage, I mean, it was the backbone of their economy. I mean, people must be suffering dreadfully.
People are suffering dreadfully, and incomes are down. The economy has collapsed, and it was making progress in advance of that, you know. So it's a shame to see it. Of course, it will recover.
But it goes back to Marion's parallel with Ireland in the 70s and 80s. You know, nobody would visit this country, despite the fact that, you know, with the level of security, that was actually quite safe to visit. And now we're doing to Egypt what people did to Ireland in the 70s and 80s. So it's worth reconsidering. An awful lot of money is invested in security in those places just because they have to protect what tourist industry they have.
Now, I'm caught between North Korea and Russia. No, we'll go to Russia because I think that appeals to people at no end. Protest rallies in Russia and the image of Putin and all of that.
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting story as well, and it sort of stresses.
Your brother lives there, doesn't he?
He did. He lived there for 10 years and he actually did some translation for work for Mikhail Gorbachev at one point in time, so he knows his stuff about Russia.
Touch the Globetrotters about the family.
There is a bit, yeah. Forced emigrants in the 1980s, Marion. You know?
Okay.
This issue of Putin has now come out in a sort of rallying call for higher moral values, etc.
As soon as you hear politicians saying that, you have to get nervous, don't you?
Exactly.
Run away.
He's looking to increase the population because population growth is, population's in decline in Russia. He's now looking for every family to have 3 kids as the norm.
A badge if you've 7, I gather.
There's a labor, a Hero of Labour Award or something like that as well. It's another thing.
Hero of the Labour Award.
Absolutely.
But the interesting thing is, you see, we in the West view Putin with some level of suspicion.
Yes,
but
indeed.
Let's not forget that he won 74% of the vote in 2004.
But did he not also have control of a lot of the media?
Well, yeah, he did. And, of course, there were allegations about election rigging in the last popular vote as well. But he still had a landslide victory.
Right.
And, you know, I think the perception...
Well, wasn't that easy to get into the election, though?
No, in fairness, it wasn't. But, and, of course, he's clamping down on the opposition heavily now, which is the reason for these protests this week. But I think we automatically assume that he's in the bad box. But actually, I think with the man on the street in Russia, not necessarily, I think.
All right. Okay. Okay, listen, just one last little story for a little sprinkling of showbiz. Depardieu doesn't like paying taxes. That's the big French film star. In about 30 seconds, can you tell them the story about what he's done?
The new French government has raised the top rate of income tax to 75%, and Gérard Depardieu has decided to move to Belgium, across the border to a little town in Belgium, in a sulk because he doesn't want to pay all that tax. And he's following a number of top businessmen. And Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, has been encouraging them all to come over here. Saying
he would too, wouldn't he? Though I'm sure that Hollande isn't going to just pass up on that. He'll probably fight back and watch him a clock. I'm going to have to say thank you to all of you for coming in. Thanks to Dennis Staunton. Thanks to Dave Mulville. Thanks to Philip O'Connor. We'll be back with you next Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 1. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Anne Farrell. Research, Elizabeth O'Neill, Susan O'Loughlin. Broadcasting coordinator, Louise Fox, and Kieran Cullen was on sound. So until next weekend, a very good day to you.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Take the hassle out of Christmas shopping with One For All gift cards. Unpost. Do more.